right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a hell of a show for you today. In fact, it's such a hell of a show that I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking at the beginning of it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Yoruba Richin, the director of a film, The New Black, which is all about black people and gay marriage in Maryland, but actually as a big question in society as a whole, all right? So that's the back end of the show. In the beginning of the show, though, we're talking with Dr. Gerald Thompson. And Dr. Gerald Thompson is one of the authors of a brand new study from a task force about the participation of medical personnel, the collaboration of medical personnel with the torturers in the Defense Department and the CIA and the U.S. military. So this is an interview I did with Dr. Thompson about a week or so ago, and we're going to just jump right into it. So check this out. Shortly after the attack on and destruction of the World Trade Centers in New York City on September 11th, 2001, the U.S. imperialists set out across the world to round up, attack, and imprison anyone they could deem a terrorist. And the people they picked up, regardless of whether they had anything at all to do with the attack on the World Trade Centers, were put into torture camps in Afghanistan, later in Guantanamo, and held and tortured in CIA prisons around the world. This was all part of the U.S. stepping out to reshape the world to serve their interests better. Well, they set out to do that, and military and intelligence agencies went out and they looked for physicians and other health professionals, particularly psychologists, who could become involved in the design and administration of this harsh treatment and, frankly, torture. And that was in clear conflict with the established international and national professional principles and laws. In 2010, the Institute on Medicine as a Profession, IMAP, and the Open Society Foundations convened the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers to examine what is known about the involvement of health professionals in infliction of torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of detainees in U.S. custody, and how such deviation from professional standards and ethically proper conduct occurred, including actions that were taken by the U.S. Department of Defense and the CIA to direct this conduct. And joining us to talk about all this is Dr. Gerald Thompson. Dr. Thompson is a professor of medicine emeritus at Columbia University, and he's also a member of the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers. And they are the publishers, the authors of a new study called Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror. Dr. Thompson, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, it's a hell of a report you guys produced. I mean, I was just, sat down and started reading it, and I thought initially I'll look at the executive summary and get what I can, and I just had to delve into the rest of it. It's just a very, very, it's a stunning and really, you know, in some ways it's stunning, much needed, and really makes you sick when you're reading it and you think about what's been going on. So I wanted to ask you the first question being, give our audience some information about the task force, how it came together, its mission, and how it was able to gather up the info that it did, because I'm sure that was a particularly difficult thing to pull together.
The task force was put together by the Institute on Medicine as a Profession and by the Open Society Foundation. The Institute on Medicine as a Profession has been around now for about 12 or 14 years to look at issues concerned with physicians' commitment to professionalism in medicine, and that premise is that patients first before anything else, communities first, society first before anything else. We knew about the war on terror, and we didn't hear too much. As you know, the first few years were conducted in total secrecy. And it was only when information began to leak out at the end of 2004, beginning of 2005, that some terrible practices were taking place amongst detainees. And then, strikingly, that physicians may have been involved, that we formed the task force to investigate and find out all we could about it.
Now, how did you come to the knowledge that there might have been medical professionals involved in this?
Well, the information that leaked out actually came from the International Committee of the Red Cross. And as you know, this is not our American Red Cross. This is the International Red Cross And they look at prisoners' conditions around the world and generally report to the governments involved, not to the public. But a part of a report on detainees that had been held by the CIA in offsites and transferred to Guantanamo, part of that leaked out into the press. And what the public heard and read was striking and very, very disturbing. And then as more and more information came to the fore, we began to understand that physicians and psychologists were involved in monitoring interrogations and developing interrogation procedures. Mm-hmm. We had no documents beyond those available to the public. We could not get access to confidential or classified documents, so that the entire report is based on information that is publicly available.
Now, was there any attempt to block any of the information that you might have gotten?
Not that we know of. We didn't face any resistance. I would say one thing that we interpreted as resistance, maybe not in a fair way. But, you know, we couldn't find anyone who served as a medical professional during that period of time who has had anything to say about this. With the exception of, you note that Admiral Shimkus is part of our task force,
mm-hmm.
and he was at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Station Hospital during that time. But other than that, no one has really come forward, none of the health professionals.
Wow. Well, let's jump into this, because the study points to three key elements in actions taken by the U.S. government after 9/11 that impacted the role of medical professionals in detention centers, and specifically with regard to torture. Can you just sort of give people a capsule understanding of what those three key elements were, and we'll talk about them individually as we go along?
Sure. They were really very important when one looks at how, why, and under what circumstances all this happened. The first very important element was the declaration of a war on terror by the White House. This was immediately after the 9/11 attack. And included in that was another declaration that the prisoners captured, taken custody in that war on terror, were not to be prisoners of war. They were to be designated as unlawful combatants, and they would not fall under the protections of the Geneva Convention. Very important. The second was the development of explanations and sort of distortions of the ethical principles under which doctors operate in dealing with detainees, indicating that the physicians did not have to follow ethical principles dealing with prisoners or detainees under these circumstances, because this was a situation in which national security was at risk, that they had to put those principles aside, and that the military, the Department of Defense, would interpret for them what ethical principles they were to follow. They also indicated that the physicians and psychologists and other health professionals could abide by ethical principles when they were taking medical care of detainees. But if they were somehow involved in the interrogation process, that they were no longer functioning as physicians, but as combatants.
Wow.
They also used or interpreted for the physicians that their role was really that of safety physicians or safety health professionals to prevent harm to the detainees. The third element, which was very important, as we've just mentioned it, is secrecy. It's amazing that the public, no one but the insiders, knew what was going on with detainees, either in the CIA custody or in the Department of Defense custody, for about 3 years after 9/11. That was a long time, and secrecy allowed a whole lot of practices to be developed without the scrutiny of the medical profession, of the public, or anybody else who would be interested in treatment of prisoners of war.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Gerald Thompson. And Dr. Thompson is a member of the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers. And that task force was the author of a study that was called Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror. And Dr. Thompson is also a professor of medicine emeritus at Columbia University. Now, Dr. Thompson, the stuff that you were saying, that was a real game changer overall in this whole scene around detention and the treatment of detainees, right?
It sure was.
When I was reading the study, it broke it down along two lines for a while. And sometimes they interpenetrated with each other, but there were two definite things I wanted to talk about a little bit separately. One was the CIA. and the fact that how did the involvement of medical professionals with the CIA develop? There's been hints of this over the last 11 years or so, where people have begun, psychologist associations and whatnot. There's been big battles, international conventions about what people were doing in terms of relating to the torture of detainees. But how did this develop with the CIA using medical personnel in the way that we're talking about here?
Yeah, there was a real sense of urgency, as we all can imagine, right after 9/11. The White House, the government felt that they needed to get information. They needed to get it fast. It had to be accurate. So they swept up large numbers of folks that they thought in the Middle East were either terrorists or might have information on terrorists. And the CIA got involved, and they put in custody people who were thought to be high-level detainees and have a lot of very, very useful information who needed to be interrogated quickly. What they did immediately was to take a look at a program that was being used to train our service people, the Air Force, Army, and Marines, train them to resist interrogation. This was a process of training for those service people that took place just began after the Korean War. And they were trying to train the service people to be able to resist harsh interrogation. That was called the SARE program. And it was run by psychologists. So they asked the psychologists to try and transform some of those techniques that were used to train the service people into methods that would be used for interrogation of detainees. And that's what was done, so that those methods were available to be used on the first detainee who was questioned by the CIA in an offsite in early 2002. What they did, in addition to developing the techniques, they submitted those techniques, all 10 of them, to the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department. And the Justice Department, using information provided by the CIA, indicated that each of those methods of interrogation in turn was legal under United States law. What they would do is ask the CIA, in the process of coming up with the memorandum, well, this particular form of interrogation, do you have any evidence that it caused extreme pain, suffering, either physical or mental? And the CIA would say, no, we have no such information. CIA was reporting on its use in the service people, which was an entirely different situation than using it on detainees. So by June of 2002, the psychologists were then armed with a memorandum indicating that these 10 methods of interrogation were legal, and they proceeded to interrogate the first detainee who was thought to be a high-level detainee at an offsite, which was thought to be in Thailand.
Well, that's, I'm sitting here thinking about this. And then in 2005, it expended like 14 interrogation techniques, right? Because I'm trying to think about this in terms of how these medical professionals actually then were involved in all this. Because I know the CIA, when they said that their things, they were sure that their things weren't causing permanent harm or that they weren't causing too much pain and suffering, that they were saying that was supposedly based on medical opinion. And were there already these medical professionals in there working with the CIA to do this?
Hard to tell, Mike. The CIA is tough to understand. They have what's called an Office of Medical Services in the CIA, OMS. And it's hard to figure out who's involved in that OMS. So what you would see in the memorandums, if you read them, is sort of a dialogue going on where the Office of Legal Counsel would say, you have information that dowsing in cold water does not produce severe pain and suffering, either physical or mental, and allegedly the OMS, whatever that is, it's an office, we don't know whether there are actual doctors in there saying this, would say we have no evidence of that. In our experience, it doesn't cause pain or suffering. So in that regard, the information given to the Office of Legal Counsel is sort of mysterious. I would say this, in retrospect, very important. That first memorandum which came out in August of 2002, which specifically judged as legal the 10 procedures to be used on that first detainee. As you indicated, it was followed by two more memorandums in 2005, which looked at a total of 14 such methods, and another memorandum which looked at the use of methods in combination. All of those geared to justify legally the use of these interrogation techniques. All of those memorandums were judged to be null and void, were thrown out when President Obama in 2009 issued his executive order as soon as he got into office, which voided all memorandums. And later, when they were looked at legal, they were thought not to be valid, none of the memorandums.
What? And John Yoo was in charge of doing all that? Well, that's a major surprise. Well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Gerald Thompson, professor of medicine emeritus at Columbia University and a member of the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers, which authored the study Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror. Now, Dr. Thompson, let's move on to the Department of Defense, because here's where some really unique things seem to have cropped up, one of them being that in relation to facilitating medical personnel involvement in torture, the Behavioral Science Consultation Teams, or BISCTs, as they're popularly known apparently in the military. So what can you tell us about this aspect of things?
Well, this was a unique development in the context of using or having health professionals involved in the whole interrogation process. The first Behavioral Science Consultation Team was formed at Guantanamo Bay in June of 2002. So this was almost going on around the same time that the interrogation of that first detainee was being done by the CIA. The Behavioral Science Consultation Teams were designed to have a psychiatrist, an MD, a psychologist who is a PhD, not an MD, but a trained expert in psychological issues, and an enlisted man or person, a mental health technician. And these behavioral science consultation teams would interview detainees, particularly with respect to their psychological makeup, trying to identify psychological trends or frailties, perhaps, which would be given then to interrogators to help them design the specific strategy for that detainee using that information. That use of medical information for that kind of purpose, of course, is totally, highly unethical. The behavioral science consultation teams went beyond that. They were expected to have a great deal to say about the success of the interrogations. They assessed them and looked at the outcomes, tried to figure out which were more successful than others, perhaps. They had something to say about the general conditions in detention facilities, both at Guantanamo and later on at other facilities in the Middle East. That is, with respect to whether the conditions were conducive to facilitate the detainees giving information. They also had something to say about personnel and how well they were performing. They were present during interrogations. Once again, that is totally unethical for physicians to be present during any interrogation for any purpose. So the BISCTs had a lot to do in an ongoing way with the whole conduct of the interrogations. It is an aspect of all this that is concerning, because the BISCTs are still in business. They're still there. They've changed a bit, as far as we know, so that it's not the usual to have a psychiatrist. Usually they're psychologists and mental health technicians. But they're still in play, and they've become part of almost institutionalized in detention settings.
Well, this is extremely disturbing in terms of this thing of one of these psychologists who's actually, as I understand it, their core role was actually helping to design torture and including using, as you said, using these detainee medical records to customize all this. And that's still being, I'm sure that the core function hasn't changed, if that's actually the definition of a core function, you know. So that is extremely disturbing.
It's changed in some respects, mm-hmm. and it would be maybe stepping too quickly to say that their function was to design torture. Their function was to design, it seems to us, to design methods of questioning that would produce supposedly reliable and actionable information. That, by the way, is highly questionable. That any of this harsh interrogation mm-hmm. produce any information that was reliable whatsoever. That some of those techniques used produce severe pain and suffering, physical and mental, and went over the line to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and torture, was a byproduct of the interrogation methods that were designed, but a byproduct that a line that should never have been crossed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And actually, what I was trying to get at in the question was, and I think you're answering it, you know, was that not so much that they designed like how big the pins should be to stick in people's eyes or something, but more that they were customizing things in terms of what would get the most information out of the detainees. And that seemed to be something that your report was actually, you know, hitting on a lot in relation to this. So I think you answered that question. Tell me this, though. One of the things is, here you are faced with all these detainees are faced with a situation where, frankly, they need medical care, but yet they have this idea, or do they have this idea? Are they aware of the fact that these are medical personnel in the room with them while they're being interrogated and torture is being used against them? Are they aware that these are medical personnel? And how does that impact I know the study speaks to this is in terms of it having a negative impact on the ability of, or the desire of people to even, you know, get medical treatment that they may need to live their life out and to even stay alive.
That's an important aspect of this whole thing. The first problem is that it was difficult for the detainees to tell who was whom in the room. I mean, they might be wearing a white coat or something, but not identified as, hey, this is a doctor, this is a nurse, this is a physician assistant, this is a tech. They, in reporting, sometimes confusingly, and accounting for what happened, might identify someone as a doctor who wasn't a doctor. That was a difficult problem for the task force, trying to sort all that out. The other end of this, though, is much more important. To the extent that they thought that the people were doctors, or that they identified them as health professionals, or even part of the medical team, to have them in the room while they were being harshly interrogated and treated inhumanely, and to have them saying nothing about it, not intervening, interfered severely with their trust in anyone who was part of the medical establishment in these detention settings. They had to get care from them. They had to be treated for their wounds and illnesses and whatnot. But I think it's fair to say that there was a high level of distrust among the detainees in all of these sites with respect to the medical personnel because what they saw as their interface with the interrogation process.
Well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Gerald Thompson, professor of medicine emeritus at Columbia University and a member of the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers, which authored the study Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror. Let's jump into this thing, and this is sort of in the category of ethical conflicts, but it also still involves some of what we've been talking about, which is sort of a bridge between them, and that is hunger strikes. And there's been a specific, you know, atrocity of the role of medical personnel in actually breaking hunger strikes, which is both a, you know, one would think it'd be an ethical conflict on one hand. At the same time, it would also be, you know, I mean, just talk about assisting in something that is just a terrible, terrible amount of suffering that the person's going through, you know, as part of a political protest. And here these people are designing these ways and helping to implement these ways to actually carry out this specific form of what I think is torture in its own right, breaking a hunger strike through forced feeding.
Well, most people who've looked at this situation very carefully and studied it would totally agree with you, Mike, that it is, force feeding is cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And as I'll get to in a moment, many think it's really torture. Hunger strikes are not unusual. They've been in play since the early 1900s and have occurred repeatedly in settings in which prisoners had no way to demonstrate against their situation or conditions other than by hunger strikes. There were several hunger strikes at Guantanamo Bay starting in 2002. And then in 2005, there was a severe prolonged hunger strike. And it's at that point that the detention facility began to use force feeding. Now, as you might imagine, over the years, there have been so many hunger strikes that the World Medical Association, that is the pinnacle of development of ethical principles for on a global level, and it's really linked heavily to the development of ethical principles for guiding physicians in the United States from the AMA and the American College of Physicians. The World Medical Association established a set of principles in 2006 indicating what is the ethical approach to treating a patient who is on a hunger strike. And one of the things they said very, very strongly, there should not be any force feeding. No person on a hunger strike should be forced to take in nutrition by involuntary means. Now, the force feeding that took place at Guantanamo was really force feeding. And this is important because what we talked about before happened behind the curtains until 2005. Force feeding is going on now at Guantanamo. And the protocol for dealing with force feeding at Guantanamo, the protocol which guides and directs the medical personnel to do this and that, is out there. The public understands it. It is public knowledge. Force feeding means that the detainees are generally forcibly extracted from their cells. I mean forced, like by military police. They're taken and forcibly put into a specially designed chair. They are strapped in so that they cannot move their legs, their arms, their torsos or bodies. They can't even move their heads. And then a tube is forcibly inserted into the nose, through the nose, and down the esophagus into the stomach. This procedure of intubation with the tube goes on routinely in American medicine, every kind of facility that cares for patients. When the patient agrees to do it, it's not a problem. But if the patient is resisting and strapped down so they can't even move the head, the only resistance they have is trying to resist by using the muscles in the throat, and the tube is being forced down the esophagus, this is force feeding. The two words are clearly understood. And that is judged to be cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and also under the circumstances of the force that is used, torture. Now, that it shouldn't be done is clear in terms of medical ethical principles that the world understands and the medical profession certainly understands. But the need to do force feeding in hunger strikers is not clearly established at all. Hunger strikers who are not taking in food must take in water. If they don't take in water, they'll die within a few days. So they're drinking water, and if they get a vitamin or so in that water and maybe a little glucose, they can go on for weeks and months without either harm or threat to their lives. The protocol at Guantanamo and the previous protocol at Bagram in the Middle East called for force feeding to be launched when certain criteria were met after 21 days, when there was a certain decrement or decrease in weight. Then force feeding had to start, and with it all of what I've described, all the force and all the loss of autonomy. And involved in that were the doctors originally, and in the last protocol, doctors involved in expediting the decisions in the protocol, but nurses involved in actually doing the feeding. So this is a current example of what would be considered by medical professionals to be improper treatment of hunger strikers and what would be considered to be unethical treatment. Now, we know that it's a big problem for the detention center, and it's been said that the reason for the involuntary feeding and the forced feeding is to save lives. You know, folks who understand hunger strikers can't totally agree with that as a basis for forced feeding, since many hunger strikers have been kept in reasonable condition without forced feeding. One of the things that's interesting about the hunger strike at Guantanamo, if you look at the numbers, starting with 30 or 40 and then going up to a high of around 100, and the length of time that they were on a hunger strike, like 8-10 weeks, and then you had only maybe 30 or 40 people on forced feeding. Some of the people who've been on hunger strikes for many weeks apparently were not thought to need forced feeding by the Department of Defense. And you begin to wonder whether there were some partial hunger strikers there, some people who were getting a little more nutrition than usual, which is okay. But the disparity between the numbers that were reported to have had forced feeding and the numbers who were on hunger strike has not really been explained.
Well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Gerald Thompson, professor of medicine emeritus at Columbia University and a member of the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers, which authored the study Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror. Let me ask you this, we're moving towards the conclusion, but I have a couple more questions. And we're talking about all this in terms of this ethical conflict that develops, and the fact there's been a lot of sort of weaselly moves by the government to actually deal with this ethical conflict. The fact that they have equated ethical standards with legal standards, which is a much lower standard of accountability in morally and in every other way. And they've also done these things. I mean, I see these things that are going on that, and I read it in a report, and it sort of, on the one hand, made you just sort of like, what? When they, you know, and then on the other hand, you step back and you think about this and what this means for how things develop. The fact that they changing the ethical standards, one of the things that they used to get around it was they began classifying medical people as combatants.
Right.
Which apparently freed them up to do all kinds of things.
Well, it freed them up to be directed, according to them. And we have to keep in mind that none of the mistreatments that we're reporting that involve physicians either as observers or whatever were initiated by the physicians.
Right, exactly, yeah.
This is all
yeah.
protocol-directed, regulations-directed. That is a very important concept if we're to get clearly on the way to repairing the situation so that it does not happen again. That's why the task force really wanted to find out more details about what happened and how it happened. What needs to happen, in our view, is that the rules, regulations in military detention settings and with the CIA that govern what physicians and other health professionals do have to be brought into line with standard medical, ethical, and care principles so that when physicians are involved in taking care of prisoners of war, not detainees, but prisoners of war protected by Geneva Convention, that they are not violating their ethical or professionalism principles. That's what we're hoping to get some movement on, so that at least it will be much, much more difficult for this to happen when the next urgent situation comes up.
Well,
we're likely to see that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, Dr. Thompson. One of the things that got me, too, was that, you know, there was another, and when I was talking about that, freeing them up, I meant freeing up the torturers, not necessarily the medical personnel, but actually the combatants, being classifying medical people as combatants, actually, apparently from what I read, lowers their level of responsibility even for being in the room when this stuff is happening. And it's similar to that equating ethical standards and legal standards. But there was another thing, too, that I thought in terms of what the government has done, what the CIA and the military has done, in terms of defining the role of medical people as safety officers, which was like something that you just couldn't, you know, it was like one of these things that gets pulled out of the Superman Bizarro world. Here they are sitting in there and they're safety officers suddenly. That is really, really outrageous.
Well, that sort of says it, at least the medical professionals, that hits them between the eye. So instead of saying, a medical professional saying, hey, you're not supposed to do that at all, they were being asked not to say you can't do that because it's cruel and human degrading treatment. They're being asked to function as a safety officer, in other words, calibrating the degree of discomfort. So it doesn't approach illegality. You see the difference?
Mm-hmm.
of course, the medical profession was just horrified, as the public should be, that anyone could say that physicians functioning in a particular setting are not really physicians. That's totally not in keeping with medical professional standards. And it gets to the point we would want to make in the final analysis. It should get to a level of discomfort with the public. If we allow, with the knowledge of what happened, if we allow this to go unaddressed, and our physicians, society accepts the premise that our physicians, who are supposed to be guided by what they do, guided by medical ethics and professionalism, patient first, if we allow that to be, those concepts to be trumped in the name of anything, in the name of being a doctor in the National Football League and approving some guy with a concussion to go out there and play because it's good for the team, or even in a setting in which national security is a prime concern, then we're headed for a slippery slope situation, and society and the profession will suffer. That's why we think this is very, very important, and the more the public and the profession gets onto this, the more likely we are to be able to get something done about it.
All right, Dr. Thompson, on that note, I think we'll wrap this up. But thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay. And we'll talk to you again sometimes, maybe under better circumstances.
I hope so.
Okay, Dr. Thompson, take care.
Right.
Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Dr. Gerald Thompson. Dr. Thompson is a professor of medicine emeritus at Columbia University, and he's a member of the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism in National Security Detention Centers. And that task force is the author of a brand new study called Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
The British police are the best in the world. I don't believe one of these stories I've heard about them raiding our pubs for no reason at all, lining the customers up by the wall, picking out people, knocking them down, resisting arrest as they're kicked on the ground, searching their houses, calling them queer. I don't believe that sort of thing happens here. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way.
All right, welcome back. That was the Tom Robinson Band with Glad to Be Gay. Just recently had the opportunity to see a film called The New Black. And I have to tell you, it was a film that, one, and I watched it a couple times, actually, and it made me think a lot about the question that's posed there. It was disturbing. It was inspiring. But most importantly, I think it was really thoughtful. And it really, I think, has the potential to spark a broad debate around critical questions in terms of people's humanity and the importance of recognizing humanity, the importance of actually people taking a stand for what's right, and for when you know what's right, that you actually do have to take that kind of stand. And that film, as I said, was called The New Black, and its director is Yoruba Richin, and she's here to talk with us today. Yoruba, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Sure. Well, I want to jump in. Congratulations on a very interesting film, too. I think it was, as I said, it was really one of those things that caused me to watch, and think. And I hope that's getting repeated across the country. So,
yes.
Okay. Well, tell people what The New Black is about and what does the title mean?
Well, the film looks at how the African-American community is grappling with the gay rights issue in light of the gay marriage movement, and this sort of fight over the meaning of civil rights. And it takes place in Maryland during the 2012 election, where a ballot initiative for marriage equality was on the ballot, a referendum. And in Maryland, African-Americans were 30% of the voting bloc. So both sides were vying over the African-American vote. And I followed the activists who were working to pass this ballot initiative. And I also look very closely at this issue of homophobia in the Black church, where Maryland also has a big church community. And obviously that's an issue, how the African-American church is kind of, how they're sort of grappling with this issue is important to understand when looking at the African-American community.
We will get into that a little bit more in the interview, but I wanted to ask you another thing here, too, because there was a reference, I think it was in the film or around the film or about the film, about this being the unfinished business of Black people being free. Can you explain what you were talking about with that?
Yeah, well, that's our character, Sharon, who says that. This is the unfinished business of Black people being free. And for her, the fight for LGBT rights is a fight for African-American LGBT folks to have a voice in our own community and in the larger national and international stage. And so she sees this as part and parcel of, you know, our historical fight for civil rights. This is, as she says, this is the next step, the unfinished business of creating freedom for all of us in the Black community.
Now, one thing that I found very interesting, you know, in the film, there's a lot of talking about the shock of Proposition 8 in California and how that actually played a role in deciding to do this film, as well as the other things you were mentioning, and including the fact that there was one point in there where I think Sharon said was that basically people in the gay community thought that, well, Black people are our natural support base, our natural, it's
right.
just natural that people would come and want to support this assertion of the humanity of gay people. But they found out that there was, that it was a different situation. And so they didn't go into it. They didn't jump in and try and organize people around gay marriage and supporting gay marriage. Instead, they found out later that, well, it was a more complicated situation then.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that Proposition 8 out in California, obviously, was such was a big learning for the LGBT activists who ran that campaign. And I think that it was a big moment in, you know, how this relationship was being understood between the African-American and the LGBT communities. And I think what you see in Maryland is the sort of results of what they learned and how not to do what happened during Proposition 8.
At the same time, it's interesting, too, though, because there really was, you also got a sense of, this is a very polarizing question. It's in society in general, but also in particular in terms of the Black community, it was a very polarizing question.
Absolutely. It is in general. I mean, we have to remember this is an issue that we've been grappling with as a country, and there's been a lot of evolution and change around it in the last few years. So, you know, the African-American community is no different, really, than other communities that are grappling with this. It's just that we have a unique history of freedom struggle and how, you know, of our continual fight for rights and, you know, and how this LGBT movement sort of intersects and rides along with that, you know, that historical movement.
Was there anything that really surprised you in relation to what you're talking about when you went out and talked to people in the community about this? Was there anything that really jumped out and surprised you?
Well, I think that when I started the film, I didn't necessarily know that part of our understanding of the issue has to do with our history of a family in this country, and that it's not just about the right to give people the, you know, the right to marry, but we also have a very particular history around it. We were not allowed to have a family brought to this country. There were laws relegating who we were able to marry, miscegenation laws. So, you know, I did not know that I did not think when I started this about the historical understanding of family and an aspiration of family. I didn't understand how that is also shaping our views around this issue.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Yoruba Richin about her film, The New Black, and it's all about the fight for gay marriage equality, and it takes place in Maryland, but it's all over the country and, frankly, all over the world. So it's something that people should be checking out and thinking about. Now, Yoruba, one of the things that I wanted to get into, and you started to get into this earlier, the role of the church and religious forces in general in fostering, you know, sentiment on both sides, both homophobia as well as support. Let's dig into that a little bit. You know, and for instance, it's actually true that the argument both against same-sex marriage is almost entirely religious. And then there's people that come at it from a religious standpoint who say, well, it's because of my religion, I can be supportive of that. What do you think of all that?
Well, I think that, again, like in other, you know, church and other church communities, we see this struggle of a conservatism that, you know, goes through all churches, and a social conservatism, and this sort of interpretation of what God says, you know, or what God allows, that eliminates some people from having rights. And then we also see, as we've seen, you know, in other movements, we see the church as a base of as a foundation of a place for freedom, and as part of the freedom struggle. And I think what's happened in the church, in the Black church, you know, speaking, you know, very generally, is that there has been an opening about the issue in the last couple of years. And a part of it is because of President Barack Obama coming out for marriage equality, the NAACP. So there's a new conversation that's happening, I think, around the issue that hasn't happened before. And it's happening in the church. And actually, that's what the title is. You asked me before what the title means. The title ultimately means the new Black conversation that is taking place on the LGBT issue.
Mm-hmm. And that's important. Although at the same time, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, I have two questions that I'm going to ask you. One, it'll be a little bit, sort of push us ahead a little bit, but I want to actually also come back to something too, because I still think there's something more to explore in what we were just talking about. But following up on that, you know, there is a point too, though, that in the sort of the more backward aspect of the religious opposition in Black churches and that what they're fostering among people, was the idea that, and this struck me pretty hard, the idea there were some of these ministers that were talking about that LGBT people were going to push Black people back to the back of the bus. And there's really a lot in that statement, you know, including the idea that somehow Black people now have made it. And when you look at the conditions of Black people, wow, is that ever a lie? You know, so let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, that's a pretty intense line that the minister says, you know, actually on the Donahue show in the 90s, that African Americans will be back on the back of the bus again. And I think that comes from, you know, this idea that if we, not just an African American community that we have, but, you know, if one sort of oppressed group makes it, it has to be at the expense of the other oppressed group. And that's something that I think we've seen in different kinds of movements. And this fear that, you know, the gains that we're still working towards and that we're still trying to get are going to be somehow taken away or ignored when this other group starts trying to, you know, get their rights. So I think I don't think it's limited to the Black community. I think it's something that we've seen. I think it's the way politics can kind of take place in this country, that it's two groups fighting over the same little, you know, small piece of the pie, as opposed to demanding an expansion of the pie.
Right, and blaming each other for their oppression, as opposed to actually looking up and seeing who's really got their foot on their necks, you know?
It's a classic. I think it's a classic kind of thing. And remember, it was also, too, that the Christian right sort of took advantage of that sort of tendency that we have. And they were able to, starting in the 90s, sort of insert themselves and work with powerful Black church members on promoting and advocating an anti-gay political agenda. And I don't know if you remember the scene in Maryland where we see the documents are revealed that the National Organization for Marriage had a specific written out strategy to divide Blacks and gays.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Yoruba Richin about her film, The New Black, and it's all about the fight for gay marriage equality, and it takes place in Maryland, but it's all over the country and, frankly, all over the world. I was going to ask you to talk about that a little, the wedge strategy, which was very, very important for people to see and understand. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, this came out. What was amazing about this film, too, about making this film, is that so much had started to happen around the issue. And one of the things, I think this is all in the space of, like, you know, 6 months, like when these documents were released, and, you know, then later, or before, I forget, Barack Obama came out in support, and then the NAACP. But these documents showed that they were found by the Human Rights Campaign in a court case that they were doing in Maine, actually. And they had a FOIA request, I believe. And the documents showed that the strategy of the National Organization for Marriage, which is the leading, you know, anti-gay marriage organization, have specifically wrote up a strategy that says we want to divide Blacks and gays on this issue, the sort of these two core Democratic base of the Democratic Party. We want to divide them on this issue and make them, you know, appear that they're prejudiced if they don't, you know, support gay marriage. I forget what the exact wording is, but that was the sort of stated strategy, divide blacks and gays on the marriage issue.
Yeah, and one of the things, I mean, it was very heavy because it was this one guy that was sitting up there and saying, well, imagine if a bunch of us, and he was a large, older white guy, and he's saying, imagine if a bunch of us went out and tried to tell black people, look, get up against this gay marriage thing because it's not, you know, it's not good, it's not that. And he says, they would just look at it and says, like, look, these are bunch of racist crackers out there doing this stuff. At the same time, he says, now imagine if we can get these preachers that they ended up working with to get out there and say and do some pretty despicable stuff when you think about it.
Right. So he basically says, he's like, when a black minister got up there, you know, this is Phil Burris, who is head of a local, you know, Christian, evangelical Christian right organization in Cincinnati. And he says, when a black minister got up there, there was nothing anybody can do. They, you know, they were scared of him. So, you know, he lays it out pretty much why they wanted to work, you know, why they thought it advantageous to work with the black ministers on this issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, another aspect of this, too, is that there was a lot of money going to the black mega churches. And it wasn't just from the National Organization for Marriage, but that federal faith-based initiatives that was pouring all kinds of stuff in there. What impact did this have?
You know, the money part, I think, is a little complicated in that, yes, there was money from the National Organization of Marriage going into the anti-marriage equality campaign. But there is also big money, too, coming from the national organizations for pro-gay marriage. So really what I didn't focus on the money issue because I think you can look at both sides are getting national support. But it was that strategy, I think, that was so shocking to people, that this is this divisive strategy. And it's supposed to be an organization that's, you know, promoting love and, you know, in their view, this is the way, you know, a way that you should, you know, have family and love and all that. And they're promoting this divisive strategy. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think about it. But to me, that's really the part that's shocking.
Yeah, and that's a big part of what I was going to ask you about in relation to these faith-based initiatives, because it really was cloaking things there was a huge ideological battle going on right in the midst, at the heart of all this, you know, in terms of, you know, were people going to be recognized as humans, or were they going to be somehow, you know, under the assault of religious, you know, religious faith or backwardness? And I'm not saying all of it, because it is very interesting to me that, you know, people can often hold two thoughts in their mind at the same time. So you see, you know, while you have all this religious backwardness out there going and just assaulting, you know, gay people, at the same time, then you had some very moving scenes between a young woman who was, you know, coming out to her adoptive mother, I guess, her foster mother. And it was very, very moving, the way that developed, or even at that cocktail, that party, that barbecue or whatever it was at the other woman's house, where people were wrestling with some very deep questions about, that were posed, a very deep ideological questions about people and how, you know, what should people's rights be and what's wrong, or what's wrong with two people who love each other being able to get married. Well, you know, and there was a lot of deep wrestling, which I found very, 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 very cool, actually.
Yeah. I mean, we were so, I was so lucky and grateful that, you know, that I was able to get that intimate access into the characters' family, and, you know, as they are being political outwardly and fighting for this referendum, there, of course, is what's going on within their own household, within their own, you know, their own communities, their own families around their sexuality. So I think it was really important for me to, you know, to be able to show those scenes with a clear view that I don't think we always get to see, especially diversity of opinion among African-Americans.
I want to close out with one question, and I'm going to leave people hanging on the rest of it. And in fact, if you don't know, folks, if you don't know what the outcome of the election around gay marriage in Maryland was, you're going to have to see the film to find out, or I won't tell you. You can go and become internet savvy and look it up. But you can also see the film, which would be a the best way to find out, all right? But let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, Yoruba. One last question. And I don't know how to pronounce the man's name, but the gospel singer. Is it Tone?
Tone.
Let's talk about Tone, because I think that was a shocker on a lot of people's sides. People watching it, people who were there. And it was a very cool shocker. So let's just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, not to give away too much. I appreciate you keeping your audience in suspense. But Tone was such an interesting character to me because he was a gospel singer, grew up in the church, was a very well-known gospel singer, and he, you know, decided to publicly be truthful about his sexuality, and the repercussions were immense for him. And he, again, it was that personal as political. I mean, he was the sort of personal fallout. His character and his story symbolized the sort of personal fallout that was the stakes, you know, for that are exist around, you know, being honest and true to who you are. So, yeah.
All right. On that note, we'll have to wrap this up. But Yoruba, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And can I just tell folks that if they're interested in finding out when the next screening is or bringing the film to their community, they can go to www.newblackfilm.com or Facebook, Twitter, The New Black, the New Black Film. So we'd love to, you know, we're bringing the film all across the country. We're going to be airing on PBS in the summer. So please look out for us.
All right, definitely, Yoruba. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. Bye.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Yoruba Richin. Yoruba is the director of the film The New Black. Check it out if you get a chance. And if not, listen to the interview and think again and again and think about this, all right? Because it's a huge question that we got to actually get down on and get together on, all right? So right about now, this brings us to the end of yet another show. And again, I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Nellish Lalani. And I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. If you want to follow me, you can do that on Facebook and Twitter. And you can also like me on Facebook. And again, as I told you, I'm secretly waiting for secret superpowers that will enable me to do so much more. So like me on Facebook and let's get out there and basically plot to take over the world. We're going to go out now with Caravan from the Balkan Brass Band. Talk to you again next week.